Spring, adapted from kindness for all living beings. March 20th, 10:46 a.m. Eastern, just this Friday past. Spring equinox, 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark. You'll notice it as a date. Everything in your yard has been counting the minutes since winter solstice. Here's what 12 equal hours does to the living things within 200 feet of your abode. The robin in your maple tree has had her hypothalamus measuring daylight through her skull, not her eyes, through the bone. Photoreceptors buried deep in the brain detect light passing through the thin skull of a songbird, bypassing vision entirely. As the day length crossed 11 hours, a cascade of hormones surged, luteinizing hormone, follicle-stimulating hormone, releasing into her bloodstream. Her ovary began developing the first egg. Friday, at 12 hours, the follicle that becomes the first egg of the year started accumulating yolk. The sugar maple tapped 3 weeks ago has been running on the freeze-thaw rhythm of late winter. Cold nights building pressure, warm days releasing it, sap rising and falling like breath. As the equinox arrives and the soil begins to hold its warmth, the tree shifts its spending. Stored starches convert to sugars that fuel not leaking sap, but swelling buds. The tap holes stop giving, not because the tree is finished, but because it has somewhere more important to send its sugar. The garter snake under your porch step is torpid but not absent. Its pineal gland, a light sensitive structure near the top of the brain, the ancient third eye of vertebrates, has been registering the lengthening days through the tissues of its skull. But here's the strange truth about garter snakes, is they mate in spring not because testosterone surges, but while it's still near its lowest ebb. Courtship in this species is decoupled from hormones in ways that still puzzle biologists. What wakes the snake is warmth, and what sends it toward others of its kind is something older than chemistry. Within days of emergence, it will be mating. The white-throated sparrow in the thicket has been eating without pause for 10 days. Pre-migratory hyperphagia, biologists call it, the compulsive fattening triggered by lengthening days. Photoperiod is the sparrow's calendar, more reliable than temperature, more precise than hunger. Friday's light to dark ratio completed the trigger. Within a week, the white-throated sparrow flies north. Burning fat, he will build in your yard. None of these organisms knew it was March 20th. They don't read calendars. They read light. And they have been reading it in bone and brain and blood since the solstice. And right now, the light is saying, go. Spring always comes with tinges of red at the tops of trees around here. The snowdrops, the daffodils, a promise of abundance in color and scent and beauty, and finally, warmth and light. It may vary from year to year, but it always comes. The forsythia, which in my belief should be allowed to grow wild and free, the cherry blossoms, and if they aren't blooming already, the serviceberry tree. Robin Wall Kimmerer, botanist and member of the Potawatomi Nation, has written a small and luminous book called The Serviceberry, Abundance and Reciprocity in the Natural World. It's just 105 pages. It's a little longer if you read what's at the back, but it's really 105 pages. I'm not going to give you a book report today. I can't. It is too vast for that, but it is beautiful, and I encourage you to read it. Its back cover says everything. All flourishing is mutual. The serviceberry blooms now, but its fruit ripens toward the end of June and lasts through July. Kimmerer writes, "This abundance of berries feels like a pure gift from the land. I have not earned it, paid for, nor labored for these berries. There's no mathematics of worthiness that reckons I deserve them in any way. And yet here they are. You could call them natural resources or ecosystem services, but the robins and I know them as gifts. We both sing gratitude with our mouths full." In the Potawatomi language, the word for service berry is bozakmen. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly. I couldn't find how to pronounce it. It is spelled B-O-Z-A-K-M-I-N. For Kimmerer, the heart of that word is the M-I-N part. It's the root word for berry. It runs through the words for blueberry, strawberry, raspberry, apple, maize, and wild rice. And men is also the root word for gift. In naming the plants who shower us with goodness, the language itself recognizes them as gifts, manifestations of generosity, care, and creativity. When we speak of something not as a commodity, but as a gift, the whole relationship changes. Kimmerer writes, "In the presence of such gifts, gratitude is the first intuitive response." And then she says something that I'd like for us to be with. "Gratitude is so much more than a polite thank you. It is the thread that connects us in deep relationship, simultaneously physical and spiritual. Gratitude creates a sense of abundance, the knowing that you have what you need. In that climate of sufficiency, our hunger for more abates, and we only take what we need in respect for the generosity of the giver." If gratitude is the first response, reciprocity is the second. And here is where gift economy lives, not as an abstraction, but as a practice. Gratitude and reciprocity are the currency of a gift economy, and they have the remarkable property of multiplying with every exchange, Kimmerer says. I accept the gift and I pass it on. You know how it goes, right? This congregation is a gift. What has been built here, the community, the welcome, the sanctuary in both senses of that word, is men, M-I-N, the gift. And if Kimmerer is right, and I believe she is, then our first response is gratitude, and our second response is reciprocity. Not obligation, not transaction, reciprocity. The energy that multiplies with every exchange, concentrated as it passes from hand to hand, a truly renewable resource. Bell Hooks wrote that to be truly visionary, we have to root our imagination in concrete reality, while simultaneously imagining possibilities beyond that reality. I'm just going to read that again. To be truly visionary, we have to root our imagination in our concrete reality, which right now is really tough, while simultaneously imagining possibilities beyond that reality. We have to have a vision, that sense that there's a better world that we know, a more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible. That's the line, right? How do we do that? We have to look clearly at where we are and then imagine beyond it. The concrete reality is this: we are living inside an economy, a world that runs on the opposite logic from everything Kimmerer describes. The gift economy says the health of the whole is the measure of success. The extractive economy says that accumulation is the measure of success. The gift economy says gratitude and reciprocity multiply as they pass from hand to hand. The extractive economy says resources flow upward and stop there. We are watching in real time what happens when that logic reaches its conclusion. When a small number of people accumulate more than whole nations of people, and they call it merit, and they call it freedom, and tell us, as Margaret Thatcher once plainly said, that there is no such thing as society, that we are each on our own, that we owe nothing much to each other or the common good. That is not a neutral economic position. It's a theological economic position, and it's wrong. I'm telling you, it's wrong. It's wrong. And we need to exist to counteract that. There are plenty of us, not just us here in this room or at UCL, but there are people. Here's what science keeps confirming, what indigenous peoples have always known. There's no such thing as a truly isolated individual, not in a forest, not in a beehive, not a monk in a cave, and certainly not in a congregation. Botanist Suzanne Simard demonstrated that a forest is not a collection of individual beings competing with each other, but rather a forest is a community of beings exchanging resources and information whose relationships are often symbiotic. Does it sound familiar? The trees are running that gift economy, and they always have been. Religion scholar Liz Bacar, in conversation with Indigenous Studies scholar Natalie Avalos, puts it this way. In Indigenous ways of knowing, the natural world is not a backdrop or a resource. Plants, animals, land, these are persons, kin, not a metaphor, but an entirely different understanding of what reality is and who belongs in it. Settler colonialism works hard to obscure this worldview because it threatens the logic of extraction at its root. Avalos, that's a quote from Avalos. And here's what she says that I want us to carry with us today. Individuals are trying to fight systems, and systems cannot be dismantled by individuals. What works is relational power, people's movements, mutual aid, solidarity. This is not idealism. It is what has historically moved things. It is what moved things at Standing Rock, where non-Native solidarity showed up anyway. It is what moved things during COVID, when neighbors fed neighbors and mutual aid networks appeared overnight like mushrooms after rain, because relational power is not a new invention. It is intuitive. We're just conditioned to forget we had it. Reverend Dwayne Davis, standing with hundreds of clergy in Minneapolis to witness against ICE, said, "We didn't do all that because we're heroes and saviors. We did it because we understand the meaning of our faith, that we are all connected. We join together. We're part of a people, a body of humanity." That is our faith as well. Love at the center, justice, equity, generosity, transformation. I was watching a little bit of an interview that Rebecca Solnit had with a New York Times reporter. And he was saying, you know, basically, we need a hero. Where's the hero that's coming forth? And she had a great response. She said, you know, we've been conditioned to think about these heroes that show up in spandex that just basically have ultimate power and can wreak havoc and violence. But that really, she quoted Thich Nhat Hanh from years ago. He said, the hero is the Sangha, is the community. that that's who's going to show up. And that's us. We hold the concrete reality while holding on to the vision that the more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible. Someone has to hold that. Someone has to hold that center. It's us, I'm telling you. It's us. And so we come to this moment, this particular spring, this particular congregation, on a church level, this first ever capital campaign, this annual pledge season, and I want to name it for what it is. It is not a financial transaction. It is not an obligation. It is a gift economy in practice. What has been built here, the welcome, the community, the sanctuary, in both senses of that word, is men. It is a gift given by those who came before us, tended by those among us now, and offered forward to those who are not yet here. It is Sangha. We are Sangha. We are the community. Kimmerer writes that gratitude and reciprocity have the remarkable property of multiplying with every exchange, their energy concentrating as they pass from hand to hand, a truly renewable resource. We carry it forward. Your pledge is that energy made concrete. It is how we say we know what we have been given. We know what this place is. We know that all flourishing is mutual. And we intend to keep flourishing together on purpose against the grain of every voice that tells us that we are on our own. The service berry doesn't hoard its fruit. It gives abundantly, and the whole forest is fed. We too are giving abundantly. Let's keep going.